I try to stay focused on the 20% of the non-devilish white folks who I not only work with, but consider my friends as well. Yes, despite my misgivings, I'm a big believer in diversity. I'm not going to blindly buy into the worst stereotypes about white people because I hate it when they blindly buy into the worst stereotypes about black people. My manager, Karen Kinney, is white, as is my assistant, Paige O'Donnell. They do great work for me every day, and I trust them implicitly, no matter what their white devil cousins are up to. Having said that, when it comes to lending a helping hand, I will always try to look out for my own first. Who are my own? Anyone from South Carolina, including white folk. If you're a white person from South Carolina, I'm going to show a positive bias towards you. I'm not saying I'm just going to hand you a job, but I will give you first dibs to prove that you're the right person for it. Now, if you're from South Carolina and you're black, man, forget about it. That trumps everything. Not only are you going to the front of the line, but I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure you get what you need once you're there. That's black and South Carolina privilege. If you think I'm conducting prejudicial hiring practices, guess what? You're right. That's exactly what I'm doing. I feel completely justified in doing it because as African Americans, we've historically been placed at a disadvantage by white people doing the same thing on a much larger scale. Every time a white boss interviews someone for a job, they're moving, either consciously or subconsciously, someone with a background similar to theirs to the top of the list. Maybe someone who went to the same college as them, or worshipped at a similar church, or whose parents came from the same region in Ireland, or someone who just knows a friend of a friend. I can't even be mad at those situations, because it's human nature for us to gravitate toward people who share similar backgrounds and experiences. Still, the end result is an informal but colossal network of friends and family that white people can tap into, but that everyone else is largely excluded from. As one of the relatively rare African Americans from South Carolina who has enjoyed success on a national level, I am absolutely going to go out of my way to show some bias toward people with a similar background. And I'd encourage every African American listening to do the same if they find themselves in a position of power. Don't get in the door and then just congratulate yourself for having made it. When you are able to wield a little bit of influence, do what you can to help a brother or a sister out. Bring in a guy from your old hood for an interview. Reach out to a sister from your college, or a guy you used to play ball with, or the granddaughter of the old lady next door. Even if you don't end up hiring them, help bring them into the system. Give them the experience of going on an interview and learning how to make a case for themselves. Let them get a taste of the corporate experience. At the very least, they'll have a better shot on the next job they go out for. God, Jewel. Get in the habit of going out on interviews for jobs you don't necessarily want. It will keep your skills sharpened and your confidence up. When a job that you do want does open up, your interview game will be on point. Interviews are like dates. The more you go on, the more comfortable and confident you'll come across. When you only go once every few years, you'll probably come off as nervous and thirsty. Now, let me switch gears slightly. If you're a white person listening to this section, hopefully it's been a bit of a wake-up call. Yes, a lot of the minorities and oppressed people you're working with do consider you to be the devil. Maybe you already sensed that, or maybe it's coming as a complete shock. Either way, it's reality. The question is, what are you going to do with this information? My suggestion is be proactive in making it clear that you're part of the good 20%, not the evil 80%. The first time you meet an African-American, a Mexican, or an Asian, or really any non-white coworker, just walk up to them and say, "Hi, I'm Tanner, and I'm not a white devil." Trust me, that will ease a lot of the racial tension in the workplace. The fact that you're white and woke enough to even acknowledge the concept of white devils will let your coworkers know you're one of the good guys. I know some white people are listening to this right now and saying, "Hell no, isn't there anything else we can do?" Now that I've got your attention, the answer is yes. Just treat people the way you'd like to be treated. Yes, I just got finished calling 80% of white people devils, but that doesn't change a fundamental fact about me. I'm incredibly polite. When I was a kid, my grandmother, Rosalie Ford, would always tell me, "Manners will take you where money won't." For a poor kid raised on a dirt road, that was an incredibly valuable lesson to have drilled into my head. Thanks to her teaching, I've always made a point to be polite and respectful to everyone I meet. When I walk into a room, I go around and look each person in the eye, introducing myself and then shaking their hand. I don't just shake the star's hand if I'm walking into a studio. I say hello to the assistants, the cameramen, the weed carriers, whoever. If you're in the same room as me, I'm going to introduce myself. I'm going to show you the respect you deserve as a human being. Energy is contagious. If you walk into a room acting grumpy and mean mugging, the room is going to get uptight. If you walk in with a hello and a smile, you automatically make the energy positive. I'm not saying you have to kiss everyone's ass. Just a hello and a smile will suffice. That's all it takes. Trust me, when people begin to associate you with smiles, positive energy, and respect, it will open so many doors. Not long ago, I found myself having the privilege of sitting in a room with Jay-Z when Beyonce happened to come in. I noticed she made a point of walking up to everyone and saying hello, even me. Can you imagine Beyonce walking up to you and saying, "Hi, I'm Beyonce"? In that moment, I understood why she's been so successful. Forget about her singing and dancing ability or her great beauty. I saw that she had tremendous manners and understood the importance of showing respect toward everyone she met. That moment cemented my commitment to introduce myself properly and show respect toward every single person I encounter. Because if Beyonce can do it, I damn sure can too. I'm a firm believer in treating people the way you'd like to be treated. If someone walks into a room and says hello to a bunch of people but overlooks me, I'm going to feel left out. Even if they didn't know me, I would still take that as a sign of disrespect. I don't ever want to make someone feel that way. My grandmother might have only been a lunch lady in Monk's Corner, but she really did understand the fundamental rule of getting ahead. When you meet someone, not only do you not know who they are, just as important, you don't know who they're going to be. That guy sitting in the corner not saying much might not be a big name today, but he could wind up being a very big deal 5 years from now. Imagine you were a young rapper walking into a studio for a meeting with Jay-Z back in 1999. Of course, you would have made a point of giving Jay a pound and saying, "What's up to Dame Dash?" But would you have made sure to say what's up to the quiet young guys hanging in the background? It would be easy to overlook them. But if you did, you would have cost yourself a chance to make a connection with a young Kanye West or a young Just Blaze. But let's say you had taken the time to show them respect and introduce yourself. "Great to meet you, Kanye. Where are you from? What do you do around here?" Who knows where those conversations could have led? Maybe to a friendship. So when they were popping, when they were the hottest producer in town, they would have given you a beat or produced a song for you when everyone else was begging to work with them. Simply because you took the time to show them that respect way back when. I hope I've made it clear how many positive lessons I learned from Wendy Williams. On the other hand, one thing I learned not to do from watching her was to treat the people who work for you poorly. Wendy and Kev could be very cruel to the people who worked under them. There were plenty of examples, but one that still stands out to me is how they treated Zoe, Wendy's former assistant. Zoe was polite, well-spoken, and just generally a sweet individual. Everyone, it seemed, liked her. So I was shocked one day when Kev and I were heading to the station and he called to check in with Wendy. Zoe answered, and Kevin just started going off on her for no reason. "Yo, if you can't handle this shit, you need to quit," he yelled before hanging up. "What was that all about?" I asked. "Nothing really. I just like messing with Zoe," he said with a laugh. "Man, she lets me talk to her any kind of way." When we got to the station, I found Zoe alone in an office crying. After I gave her a big hug, Zoe looked at me and said, "I can't take it anymore." I guess it wasn't the first time Kevin had screamed on her because she ended up quitting that day. I figured Wendy would have tried to talk her into staying because she respected Zoe's work, but she just let her go. When I asked her why she hadn't tried to stop her, Wendy just said, "Well, she was no good anyway." Now she's no good, I thought to myself. That was your girl yesterday. But Wendy was right. Zoe wasn't good. She was great. She was a beautiful person who worked hard at her job and didn't deserve to be belittled and disrespected, especially for no reason. It was demoralizing to see my bosses treat another coworker that way. I promised myself that once I made it to the level Wendy and Kevin had, I'd treat the people under me differently. Instead of messing with people just because I could, I'd show them support just because I could. I like to think I do that with the staff behind the Breakfast Club, Uncommon Sense, the Brilliant Idiots, or anywhere I work. Yes, I definitely tease and mess with people a lot, but it's always done with love, and it's always delivered peer-to-peer instead of from boss to subordinate. I expect the same from other people in positions of power. If you're a producer, an agent, a manager, or a writer working with me, I'm not judging you off how you treat me. I'm the talent in those situations, so of course you're going to treat me well. I'm judging you off how you treat everyone else who's working on the project. If I notice a director constantly screaming on a cameraman for no good reason or an agent habitually being rude to their assistant, then I'll make a note that that's someone I don't want to work with again in the future. Some have said, if you believe in treating people with respect, then why do you attack people so much in your interviews on the radio? My response is always that I don't feel like I'm attacking people. If I give my take on a story or say that I don't like an artist's song, that's just giving my honest opinion. I'll tell an artist exactly how I feel to their face and then give them a chance to respond and truly listen to that response too. I don't think there's anything disrespectful about being honest. If anything, I believe what's disrespectful is sitting down with an artist and acting like you really appreciate them in person, but then trashing them once they leave the studio. So many personalities do that. I won't. I'm going to tell you how I feel and what I think to your face and then have an honest and open conversation about it with you. People might not be used to that sort of direct approach, but to me, it's really just another example of good manners. Being upfront and honest with people, to me, is the ultimate sign of respect. It's how I treat people, and it's how I hope people will treat me. Are you coachable? No matter who you work with, black or white, men or women, gay or straight, to reach your full potential, you must remain open to good advice. I don't care how skilled you are, what sort of accolades you've received, or how big your check is. Your continued evolution depends on being able to accept criticism and advice from people who are more experienced than you. When you make the mistake of thinking you know it all, you're going to shut yourself off from so much wisdom. I see talented people fall into this trap all the time. They experience a little success and then think their talent is enough to carry them the rest of the way to the top. If they meet someone who doesn't seem as gifted or skilled as they are, they'll dismiss that person's advice out of hand. But here's a little secret. There are a lot of people out there whose main talent is their ability to coach. Phil Jackson wasn't a star as an NBA player, but he's probably the greatest coach in the history of the game. Providing instruction, vision, and guidance is his gift. Imagine if Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen had ignored Phil just because he wasn't an all-star when he played in the league. They would have missed out on so much wisdom and might have never won all those rings. Or take Coach K, a.k.a. Mike Krzyzewski of Duke, the man who is perhaps the greatest college basketball coach of all time. Coach K wasn't a pro player himself. He's a short white guy with a funny-looking face and an unspellable last name. You should have seen how I spelled it before this book was edited. Still, he has an undeniable gift of being able to communicate with and inspire his players. By being open to his instruction and buying into his system, a lot of guys have been able to make millions of dollars for themselves in the NBA. There might be a Phil Jackson or a Coach K waiting to come into your life, too. They probably won't be a basketball coach, but they could be a supervisor, a manager, or just a coworker. Someone who on the surface might not seem to have the talent that you do, but still can clearly see what is needed to be done in order for you to take that step to the next level. If that person approaches you, will you be receptive? As long as you give yourself the credit you deserve for being stupid, you'll make the right choice. When you can freely admit, I don't know everything, then you're always going to be open to more instruction. I've been very fortunate to learn under some great coaches over the years. Individuals who were able to point out the aspects of my game that I needed to improve, who didn't back away from my brashness, but stepped up and showed me how to turn it into a strength. There was Ron White, the music director at Z93 Jams in Charleston, as well as George Cook, who gave me my first full-time job in radio at Hot 98.9 in Charleston. George is the person who planted the seed in my mind that I could host a morning show. I'm also indebted to Mike Love, who hired me at the Big DM 101.3 in Columbia, South Carolina. I actually dubbed him Phil Blackson because he was such a great coach and strategist. One of my greatest coaches and great friends is Cadillac Jack. He's absolutely one of the smartest, most driven, and deliberate people I've ever met. He and G-Spin are the reason not only that there is the Breakfast Club, but also that it's the hit that it is today. I like to say that G-Spin's gift is identifying the talent and that Cadillac's is showing the talent how to grow. There's no doubt in my mind that Cadillac's guidance is one of the reasons my career was able to go to the next level. Cadillac blessed me with so many gems during our time together, but probably the greatest was teaching me the law of 10. It states that when a media personality puts an opinion or an idea out into the world, three people will like it unconditionally, 3 people will hate it unconditionally, and 4 people will be on the fence about it. Cadillac taught me that a lot of on-air personalities waste their time trying to win over the 3 haters. It's easy to understand why. If someone keeps tweeting, "Charlamagne, you are such a moron," my natural inclination is to try to show that person that I'm not. Cadillac knew better. Just ignore the haters, because nothing you say is going to change their opinion, he told me. They're not interested in your ideas. They just get off on attacking you. Instead of exhausting precious energy on the 3 people who already hate me, Cadillac coached me to focus on the 4 people who are undecided. Those are the people who are worth your effort. The other ones are already a lost cause. Man, that advice truly saved me, especially in this time when everyone not only has an opinion, but also a platform to express it. If I had kept paying attention to the haters on Twitter, Instagram, and the comments sections of YouTube, I would have gone crazy. Instead of playing verbal whack-a-mole with people who weren't even interested in having a real dialogue, the Law of 10 showed me the value in sharpening my I-don't-give-a-fuck skills to a razor's edge. I think I also gravitated toward Cadillac's advice because it reminded me of something my father always told me. You're never as good as they say you are, and you're never as bad as they say you are. Not everyone in my position would have made themselves so open to Cadillac's coaching. He's a lot older than me. He's white. He's a top 40 DJ who never played a lot of hip-hop. He's from Boston. The list goes on and on. But I didn't care about any of those factors. I could tell that Cadillac was trying to help me, and I wanted to soak up all the game he had to share. From Cadillac and G-Spin to my current coach, Thea, so many people have helped me grow and prosper professionally. But again, only because I stay receptive to both new people and new information. Coachable in the bedroom. I'd be negligent if I didn't add that being open to new information is a mandatory mindset for the bedroom as well. I learned this back in Columbia from a female friend who was also in the radio business. We don't talk that often anymore, but she knows that if she ever needed anything from me, I would be there to hold her down. That's how I am with my real friends. One night back in the day, we left the club high and drunk out of our minds. One thing led to another, and we ended up fucking. First that night, and then more frequently. Friends with benefits, as they say. I'm sure some of you have been in a similar situation. Friends with benefit status is great for many reasons, not the least of which is that your friend will keep it real with you, especially when it comes to your skills, or lack thereof, between the sheets. That was the case the first time I went down on my friend. I thought I was putting in real work, but she stopped me in mid-flirp and told me straight up, "Charlamagne, you do not know how to eat pussy." A lot of men would have gotten upset in that moment. Not me. Like I said, I've always prided myself on being extremely open to constructive criticism, even when I'm standing on the verge of getting it on. I didn't take offense, because if you're truly coachable, then you know there's a difference between someone being honest with you because they just want to break you down and being honest with you because they want to build you up. I could tell she was only trying to help me. My friend was so sincere in trying to help me earn my liquor license that she gave me a book called The Ultimate Kiss. The first half was dedicated to teaching men how to eat box correctly, while the second half instructed women how to return the favor. I studied that book like a student cramming for a test until I was sure I had the technique down. For those of you who want to practice right away, here's the Cliff Notes version. Work your tongue like a light switch, off on, off on, off on. That's what makes a girl come. Then my friend was kind enough to let me practice on her until I worked out any remaining kinks and got it absolutely right. Hey, that's what real friends are for. It's only because of her willingness to be a cunnilingus coach that today I can proudly say I am one of the best pussy eaters on the planet. Yes, I've gotten a 5-star rating from every girl who has had my big-ass mouth go down on her. Ultimate Kiss is the reason that my wife squirts every time I put my face in her Furburger. So moral of the story is, always be open to coaching. Whatever form it may come in, you never know what skill set it will help you improve. Stay open to growth in your relationships. Okay, speaking of going down on women other than my wife, I want to address the issue of my infidelities. And I hope you'll see that one of the most important things you can stay open to in life is the possibility of change in your relationships. As you might have noticed, I didn't have the best role model when it came to male monogamy. My father was a serial cheater before leaving my mother for the woman who is now his wife. He was fairly unapologetic about it, too. When I was about 17 or 18, I decided to confront my father about how he was flaunting all his side chicks. I was sitting on my bed while he rode an exercise bike I used to keep in my room. We were just bullshitting when suddenly I blurted out, Why are you so sloppy cheating on mom? The whole town can see. I'll never forget what my father did next. He looked me dead in the eye and pointed to a picture I had on the wall of my girlfriend at the time. You ever cheat on that girl? Nope, I said truthfully. Well, one day you will, and then you'll understand what I'm doing. I won't. I'm never going to cheat on her, I shot back. When I said that, my father just laughed. Not a nervous or insecure laugh, but the kind of pure laugh that can only come from someone who's lived a lot of life. Trust me, he repeated when he was done. One day you'll understand. Today I can say, Pops, you were right. Now I overstand. But it still doesn't make it right. No matter how strong the temptation, you can't allow another person to ruin your family. My pops is remarried now, and as far as I know, he's been faithful to his new wife. But I know my father's never truly been happy since leaving my mom. Every so often he tells me one of the worst mistakes I've ever made is leaving your mother. Despite my father's infidelity, literally being the talk of the town, my mother refused to let her pain and humiliation show as far as I could see. She was so good at making it appear that their divorce wasn't hurting her that for a long time, I believed her. The only time I saw, or should I say heard, the pain come through was when she would sit in her bedroom and play Lauryn Hill's X Factor over and over and over again. At the time, I thought it was just cool that my mom liked Lauryn, but as I've gotten older, I have to admit that was just wishful thinking. Look at the lyrics of that song. It could all be so simple, but you'd rather make it hard. Loving you is like a battle, and we both end up with scars. I heard that song so many times that I didn't even need to Google the lyrics just now. They're forever seared into my brain. I hate that record so much because of the pain I associate with it that sometimes I get mad at Lauryn for even writing it. If I'm discussing greatest rappers of all time and Lauryn comes up, I'll downplay her impact by saying something like, nah, she's only got one album. She can't be in this convo. That's just misdirected energy on my part. Lauryn is one of the all-time greats, yet here I am getting mad at Lauryn for expressing her pain instead of being mad at the man who caused her that pain. I don't have the heart to ask my mother if she ever got over the hurt of my father's infidelity, but I'm pretty sure the answer is no. I've never known her to date someone else, let alone get remarried. Her life seems to be going to the Kingdom Hall and doing a little substitute teaching now that she's retired. She also loves being with her grandchildren, but she deserves a fuller life than that, and I'm going to go out of my way to give it to her. As for my father, my cold heart loves it when he tells me he messed up and that the worst mistake he ever made in his life was leaving my mom. That brings me joy to hear because I believe the pain and hurt he brought to our family should be equally distributed to all parties involved. Of course, gloating over my father feeling terrible isn't the answer. Instead, I've tried to focus on making sure I don't put my wife through a similar sadness. Because for many years, if I'm being honest, I was coming close. Yes, we've been together off and on since high school, but there have been stretches when we were on where I wasn't fully committed. Certainly not to the level she deserved. Even after we had a daughter, I was still hesitant to put a ring on it. I wanted to have my cake and eat it too with other women. My wife was in pain, but whenever I sensed that pain, I just made myself numb to it like I had with my mother. I avoided the hurt and told myself that our relationship was fine. We had a beautiful daughter. I was making good money. We had a nice house and fancy things. Isn't that what every woman dreams of? Why would she need a ring too? The irony is that despite dragging my feet on the way to the aisle, I'd always been very attracted to the concept of marriage, even as a teenager, an age when most boys aren't thinking much past getting laid. I used to literally pray for a good wife, for a woman I could settle down and start a family with. Of course, when God delivered that good woman to me, I said, oh, sorry, I forgot to mention, I want some other women too. I managed to stay numb to what I was doing for years, but eventually more and more cracks began to show in the wall I'd built around myself. The first was when our daughter was old enough to start asking questions. Daddy, why don't you and mommy have the same last name, she'd ask. I'd come up with some lame excuse, but I'd hate myself for it. Disgusted that I was doing such a poor job at role modeling what a real relationship should look like. Another important moment came when I was hanging out with the legendary record executive Kevin Lyles at a 5-star resort in the Bahamas. We got on the subject of marriage, and I told him about how I wasn't sure I'd ever tie the knot. I can't tell you whether to get married or not, he said, but I can absolutely tell you that you need a good woman to share your experiences with. You can find plenty of women to take to a place like this, but over time you're going to start feeling like a piece of crap. Jump-offs are cool, but wouldn't you rather be sharing this beauty, this experience, with someone you really care about? You need to look for that person. I knew he had just dropped a jewel on me. I also knew I didn't have to look anywhere for that woman. She was already right under my bunky nose. I made a vow to myself right there. I'm not gonna live like this no more. But what really brought those walls down was when I broke the sacred code and sneaked a peek at Mook Mook's diary one day while she was out. I'm glad I did, even though what I read broke my heart. What got me was a passage she wrote just after her best friend had gotten married. Everyone around me is getting married, but I'm still not married yet. Am I doing something wrong? Is it me? Am I not good enough? Nothing could have been further from the truth. There was nothing wrong with her. My wife is intelligent, trustworthy, talented, inspiring, an incredible mother, and definitely sexy. I was the scumbag. I was the one who had to do better, not her. After that, I stopped pretending that everything was all good and got serious about doing right by this woman. I was going to put a ring on it and give her the relationship she deserved. Before we left for a vacation on the beautiful island of Anguilla, I went to her father, said I was going to propose, and asked for his blessing, which he gave me. He should have, considering how much of my Remy he's drunk over the years. Then one night during the trip, I took her out for a beautiful candlelit dinner on the beach. At some point, the talk turned to marriage like it had so many times before. It had become an exhausting conversation for Mook Mook. "Man, I'm not thinking about that shit no more," she replied. "Well, I have been," I replied. "And I decided if I did propose to you, I want to do it right. Somewhere beautiful like Anguilla. Maybe eating dinner on the beach by candlelight." She still didn't catch what I was up to. "And then I would stand up," I continued, actually standing up. "Then I would get down on my knee," as I got down on my knee. Then I pulled the ring out, and she knew what was happening. Instant tears. I asked her to marry me, and she said yes. And being my true soulmate, the next words out of her mouth were, "You have no idea how good I'm going to suck your dick tonight." Getting married was easily the best thing I'd ever done. For a long time, I'd been judging whether I was successful by how much money I was making or how well my career was going. Once I was married, I realized expanding my radio career or locking down more TV deals wasn't true success. Only marriage gives me a feeling of contentness. Raising a family the right way is the only thing that brings me pure peace. The other day, I was hanging out in the kitchen of our new home with my wife. It's a beautiful place at the end of a cul-de-sac in a fantastic neighborhood. Don't worry about how many square feet it is. I'm not the flossy type. Just know we're living well. Suddenly, I blurted out, "I feel accomplished." "Why, because of this house?" asked my wife. "No, the house has nothing to do with it. I feel accomplished because of us, because of the kids, because of this family we've built together." I wasn't lying. The house is incredible, and radio and TV deals give me a rush. But at the end of the day, as long as I have my family, I'm good. You can fire me one more time. Take away the fame, repossess the house, and send me back to South Carolina to go sit under a tree, and I'd still be straight, just as long as I have my wife and kids with me. I'd eventually figure out a way to get out from under that tree, but I wouldn't cry for anything I'd lost because I would still have everything that I needed. Recently, we were back in South Carolina, and I rented a beach house for all my friends and family. We ate, drank, told jokes, and reminisced. Our kids ran around the house, jumped in the pool, and had a great time together, just like we'd done at that same age. To see that magic being recreated by another generation was one of the best sights I've ever seen. It made me so happy that I'd stopped being stubborn and finally allowed myself to evolve into the man I'd always wanted to be. Every single one of us has the ability to break out of our bad habits and realize our full potential, to go from a bum-ass boyfriend to a happy husband, to transition from struggling to get by to enjoying sustained success. The key is to never feel like you're stuck in one place. Stay open. Be coachable. Don't rely on peers who aren't progressing, and make sure you do listen to your elders when they give you gems. The other day, a guy who goes by at MarkMark330 tweeted me, "Your journey has been crazy to watch. You've evolved, but you haven't changed. That's dope. Hashtag salute." I hit him back and wrote, "Best tweet I've got all week." But it's really one of the best tweets that I've gotten, period. Few things have made me prouder than being recognized for my evolution. No matter where I go, I'm still always going to be Leonard, Cowboy and Julie's son from Monk's Corner. But I can always work at being a better version of that South Carolina kid who set out to make it on the biggest stage possible. A better radio personality, a better businessman, a better thinker, a better friend, a better mentor, and most important, a better husband and father. Principle 8. Access your black privilege. Regardless of any system meant to oppress me, God designed me to win. The only way I can lose is if, as a black man, I allow myself to believe America is structured to make me feel inferior. But I'll never do that. Instead, I'm confident in the knowledge that every man and every woman is equal in the eyes of God. We each have our own unique privileges. It's just up to us to unlock them. I used to get my hair cut by a brother named Divine, who had a barbershop in Goose Creek. Like all hood barbershops, it wasn't just a place to get a cut. It was also a place to hang out, swap stories, and trade opinions. Divine's shop is where I saw the R. Kelly sex tape for the first time, and hence, learned how to eat ass properly. Divine and I clicked and sometimes would hang out at his place, smoking weed and discussing life. It was then that I learned that Divine was a 5%er. I know I've mentioned him earlier in the book, but for those who aren't familiar, the 5%ers are an offshoot of the Nation of Islam that was founded in Harlem in the 1960s. The group's name refers to their belief that society is divided into three groups, the first group being the masses, the 85% of the population who are blind to God and the truth. The second group is composed of politicians, CEOs, members of the media, etc., the elite 10% who know the truth but exploit it for their personal gain. That leaves the remaining 5%, 5%ers, who know the truth, namely that God is a black man, but rather than abuse it, use it to try to help people. These 5%ers are also known as the poor righteous teachers. Yes, old heads, the same name as the group that had a hit with Rock This Funky Joint back in the day. The 5%ers might have never enjoyed mainstream popularity, but the gods and the earths, as male and female members of the group call themselves, have always played an important role in hip-hop. The 5%ers have also attracted a lot of converts in jail. For many years, the prison system in South Carolina even categorized them as a dangerous gang, like Bloods, Crips, or Latin Kings. When those gods came home, they often found themselves operating in the barbershops, street corners, and clubs of the black communities, the same places where hip-hop lived. Many of the gods were charismatic speakers. Shut out from New York's main mosque and churches in the early days, the gods were forced to preach on the city's street corners. And if you're going to command a crowd on a New York corner, you better have the gift of gab. As a result, over the years, the gods developed an incredible command of language and sense of showmanship. Qualities that made them very attractive to people like myself who grew up respecting the same attributes in rappers. Divine definitely could spit a mean game. When we would build, which is a 5%ers term for discussing their beliefs and philosophies, Divine would break down how the American black man is the actual personification of God, who himself is a black man from Asia. Or he might teach me about how God is a Greek word derived from the ancient Aramaic words Gumar, Oz, and Dabar, which meant wisdom, strength, and beauty. He also taught me about the 5%ers belief, which they share with the Nation of Islam, that white people were created 6,000 years ago by a black scientist named Yaqub, who sent them into the world to be a race of devils. Those concepts might sound crazy to you, but no matter how anyone else feels about them, the 5%ers served a very important purpose to me. They made me believe in myself. It might have come in an unorthodox style, but their message was very simple. I wasn't the victim of the white man. Instead, I was a god. I had power. I was special. I was destined to be great. I had never heard that message anywhere else in my life at that point. Certainly not at school. Definitely not at home, where I was seen as a screw-up, albeit one with potential. And not at the Kingdom Hall, where the emphasis was much more about how I better not piss off God, let alone think that I was a god myself. When people ask, why do you call yourself the god? My answer is because of what I learned from the 5%ers. Whether I heard it through Divine or rappers like Big Daddy Kane, Nas, and Ghostface Killah, who all followed the 5%ers. I never forgot that the black man is God. That isn't a blasphemous statement to me, or even a suggestion that everyone else isn't a god too. It was simply a way of returning to the truth about our true nature. As the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan tells us, we have been turned backward. Instead of calling ourselves God, we say, yo, what's up, dog? I might have discovered that truth in the lyrics of a song or a barbershop chair instead of a church or a school, but it didn't diminish the gift the 5%ers gave me, empowerment. The 5%ers philosophy might sound radical, but it really isn't. The importance of believing in yourself is a concept at the root of almost every philosophy and culture. It's a message that's been shared in so many different ways, words, and platforms over the centuries. One of my favorite quotes on the subject is from the metaphysical author Christian D. Larson, who wrote, "Believe in yourself and all that you are, and know that there is something inside you that is greater than any obstacle." Larson was a white guy who was born in Iowa over 100 years ago, but he was dropping the same gem that Divine gave me in Goose Creek, a message that will never lose its shine and will always be relevant to your life no matter who you are. In fact, let me repeat it one more time for the people in the back. Believe in yourself and all that you are, and know that there is something inside you that is greater than any obstacle. Some of you might be having a hard time accepting that about yourself. Maybe you think you're too black, too dumb, too poor, too gay, too ugly, too shy, too sick. Whatever the case may be, maybe you don't feel like you have that much to believe in. Certainly not as much as the successful people you see out there living the life you'd like to lead. The most overwhelming evidence that you're special is that you're here at all. Fellas, next time you're about to bust a nut, shoot it on your lady's stomach and then really look at that puddle of semen. Consider all those squiggly sperm on her belly. Each one of them had one mission and one mission only: find its way into an egg and create a life. At that fateful moment your daddy decided to shoot up your mama's club, that's my expression for ejaculating inside a woman, out of the millions of sperm he let loose, you were the only one who accomplished this mission. A single winning sperm out of the 250 million that are in each nut. Man, the odds for you to have succeeded are worse than Powerball and Mega Millions, but you did. You were the Shaq of semen, the King James of jizz, the Steph Curry of sperm. You were incredible, a once-in-a-lifetime talent. So you're telling me that now that you're here, you're going to let something like racism, sexism, or homophobia slow you down, make you give up? After all you've already accomplished, you can't allow that to happen. You might have forgotten your epic vaginal victory, but you've already overcome much greater hurdles than any white man could put in your way. Don't get it twisted. I'm not having an All Lives Matter moment here. Not for a second am I suggesting that racism isn't real. It's as real as the air we breathe, and the evidence is everywhere. There's slavery, segregation, and Jim Crow, the effects of which are still felt strongly in every corner of America. There's the fight for civil rights, restrictions of voting rights, the prison industrial complex, systemic racism, and perhaps most wicked of all, reality TV. In particular, I'm talking about Flavor of Love and Mona Scott Young, who I respectfully call Satan Scott Young. Especially her franchise Love and Hip Hop, which I prefer to call Lies in Hip Hop, because 80% of all cast members lie about what they got. Collectively, all these institutions, laws, systems, and programs have thrown all their weight behind trying to limit black progress on this planet. They have slowed some of us down and in some cases even stopped our growth completely. I'll never deny or try to downplay just how many hurdles we've faced as a people. Despite all of that, however, in the words of Maya Angelou, "You may kill me with your hatefulness, but still like air, I'll rise." Words like that are critical to building our belief in ourselves. Black folks need reminders like "And Still I Rise," just like we need to hear the message in songs like Nas's "I Can" or Kendrick Lamar's "All Right." We can never lose sight that we are indeed gods, kings and queens, that we are superheroes with Luke Cage-type strength, capable of running through any obstacle. We've got skin hard enough to withstand anything this wicked world throws at us. That's right. Our melanin is hard as steel. We are literally too black, too strong. Nope, I'll never tell you racism isn't real, because it is, just as white privilege is real, too. Instead, what I'm encouraging you to do is stop letting them define you. You might say, "Well, it's a little hard to ignore it when no one ever replies to my resume because it reads Sharika at the top." Just as you might say, "It's a little hard to ignore it when I'm pulled over 10 times a year simply for driving while black." I understand that sort of oppression can be depressing, even deadly. But if you let it completely color your vision of the world, then you're doing the white man's dirty work for him. When all we can see is the privilege of others, then the biggest oppressor of African Americans becomes ourselves. It might not be a popular sentiment, but it needs to be said. That's why every day when you get up and look in the mirror, you need to point a finger at your reflection and say, "Fuck these crackers. White man isn't the problem here. You are holding me back. You are keeping me down. You are suppressing me from being great because you simply don't believe in yourself." Blaming yourself for not being great might seem like an exercise in self-hate, but I promise it's actually one of the most optimistic outlooks you can have. When you hold yourself accountable, what you're really doing is freeing yourself from mental bondage. You're saying, try as it might, racism can't stop me. White privilege can't stop me. If there's something out there that I haven't gotten, it's because I haven't taken it. Winston Churchill once said, a pessimist sees the difficulty in every opportunity. An optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty. When you blame yourself instead of the white man, then you're actually being optimistic. Everyone is privileged. When you first saw the title of this book, you might have said, Charlemagne tripping. Ain't no such thing as black privilege. Well, hopefully by now, I've at least convinced you that you've got God's privilege. Certainly you can admit that God made you who you are, and that it's a blessing, honor, and privilege to be you. To be so original, so unique, that God decided to make only one you. Every human being on this planet, even twins, are one of a kind. What's destined for you is destined for you only. That's an incredible privilege. If there's one thing I want you to take away from this book, it's that privilege is something that everyone can access. I call my personal version black privilege because contrary to all the bleaching and Uncle Tom rumors, I'm 100% a black man. I recognize the God in me. Doing so allows me to ignore the social norms that consciously and subconsciously tell me I'm inferior because of race, gender, or class. So no one can tell me that I don't have black privilege. No matter what sort of struggles you faced, you still possess a unique privilege. Do you have arms and legs? Good. Well, then you have limb privilege. You have an advantage over the Iraqi vet who lost his and is trying to learn how to walk on bionic legs. Or the guy who lost his arms and had to figure out how to roll a blunt with his toes. You have tremendous privilege over people in those situations, so make the most of it. Do you feel relatively healthy today? Good. Then you have health privilege. You've got an advantage over the high school teacher who has cancer, who has to receive chemotherapy after school every day and spends her nights throwing up, only to get back up the next morning and go teach her class. Or the fireman who got ALS and is now confined to a wheelchair, wasting away in front of his wife and kids until the disease finally does him in. You might be unemployed. You might be divorced. You might have just been fired from your dream job. You might be 30 pounds overweight and feeling crappy about yourself, but man, if you woke up today feeling healthy, you've got incredible health privilege over that teacher and that fireman. Please capitalize on that privilege. I know some of you probably think I'm downplaying or underestimating the power of white privilege. That's never been my intention. Remember, I was raised a poor black male in South Carolina. I lived in a trailer. I sold drugs. I was kicked out of two high schools and did time in jail twice before I was 18. I had a big nose and a funny name. Okay, a few. My face had several shades. I know what it means to be counted out, to be overlooked, to be profiled. I've experienced all those things and continue to experience them to this day. But despite all those things, I simply can't grasp the concept of someone being better than me because of the color of their skin, their position or status in life. I truly believe, as the subtitle of this book states, that opportunity comes to those who create it. I don't care what race you are, you still have to work to unlock your privilege. Contrary to popular belief, every white person in America is not successful. White skin is not an easy path to success. I saw too many white folks living in those trailer parks in Charleston to believe that to be true. White people have to go out there and get it just like the rest of us, even though in most cases it may be easier for them and harder for us. Black privilege isn't about what someone else is doing. It's just about being aware of who and what you are and drawing strength from that. So please don't confuse what I'm saying here with Lil Wayne, Raven Simone, or another celebrity who's implied racism can't exist anymore just because they've made it. Yes, I've made it, but I know not everyone has. Just because your tax bracket has changed for the better doesn't mean your reality has too. But I want it to. I want everyone listening to this program to reach their dreams just like I have. And I sincerely believe that embracing your own privilege instead of being intimidated by someone else's is the best way to do it. For everybody out there born in unfortunate circumstances, it's not how you start the race, it's how you finish it that matters. I don't care what your economic condition is. I don't care where you were born. If you tap into the power of God in you, then you can make it out of any situation. Faith plus hard work can change any circumstance. Do you understand what I just said? Faith plus hard work can change any circumstance. Belief in God is essential, but you still have to put the work in too. If I tell you that one day you're going to hit the lottery, you can't just sit around and wait for those numbers to come up. You have to actually get up, go out there, and play the lottery. Your relationship with God works the same way. You can't just pray for him to bless you. No, you must pray and then go out there and put the work in. You must allow God to help you by helping yourself. People ask me all the time, how did I get in this position? How did I go from Monk's Corner, South Carolina, to having my own radio show in 60-plus markets and counting? How did I end up with a TV deal on MTV, or doing movies, producing TV shows, and writing books? I give them one simple answer, God. And if they reply, well, how come it doesn't happen for everybody else who believes in God? I believe in God, so why aren't my blessings coming like that? My answer is pretty simple. I say you must not believe in God like you claim you do, because if you did, you wouldn't question him ever. I pray for clarity. I pray that God speaks through me. I pray that he directs my steps and moves me the way he wants me to move. I pray for forgiveness every day, several times a day. And I pray that God is with me and everybody I love and care for throughout the day. Remember, remember. My own experience has taught me that believing in the privilege God has blessed you with can be the difference between winning and losing. That's probably why losers look at me like I'm Rafiki from The Lion King when I talk about black privilege. They think I'm crazy, that I'm a coon, a sellout, that what I'm saying can't be done. To that I reply, man, shut the fuck up forever with that pessimistic bullshit. If you don't think the type of privilege I'm promoting is real, then consider the Remember Who You Are scene in The Lion King. That's the scene where Rafiki takes Simba to the watering hole and shows him his own reflection to prove to Simba his father Mufasa isn't truly dead. Simba is skeptical, but then his father does appear in the clouds and reprimands his son for losing sight of his true self. You have forgotten who you are, intones Mufasa, and so have forgotten me. Look inside yourself, Simba. You are more than what you have become. You must take your place in the circle of life. When Simba protests that he doesn't know how to go back and find himself, Mufasa tells him, remember who you are. You are my son and the one true king. Remember who you are. Remember, remember, remember. Now, when you saw that scene with your kids in the theaters, you loved it, right? Maybe you even cried a little bit because it touched your soul. That's the kind of belief you need to tap into. Please, if you're one of those people out there who feels like they can't succeed, at least stop criticizing those of us who believe we can win at life. It's hard for a loser to understand this mentality, this belief in self. It's difficult for losers to access their own privilege because they don't even believe it's sitting there, dormant, waiting to bloom. This philosophy of accessing your privilege, no matter what sort of privilege it is only for the winners, the dreamers, and the doers. Those of us who understand opportunity comes to those who take it, who understand that privilege exists within us all because God gave it to us. Not America, not this system, the white man, or any man. They can put us in chains, steal our names, deny us our rights, throw us in jail, and even shoot us dead for the color of our skin. But they still can't keep us from what is divinely ours. As Mufasa said at the end of that scene, remember who you are. You are my son and the one true king. Remember who you are. Remember, remember, remember. Just like Simba, we're all kings on this earth. To reap the privilege that is divinely ours, we just need to remember it. Acknowledgements. This is the hardest part of the audiobook to do, okay? When it's time to acknowledge the people who have contributed to your success, you're bound to forget somebody, especially when you're saying it the night before your final deadline, as I am now. So if I somehow do forget to mention you, just know that I love you. Blame it on my mind, not my heart. First off, to my iHeartMedia family, thank you for taking a chance on me, even though I'd already been fired from radio 4 times. It was a gamble that I'm pretty sure has paid off. Cadillac Jack, G-Spin, Dennis Clark, Doc Winner, Thea Mitchum, Bob Pittman, Richard Bressler, John Sykes, Tom Pullman, thank you all. To The Breakfast Club, DJ Envy, Angela Yee, Q, Sasha Katie, M-Eazy, even though Sasha and Q have moved on in their careers, in the beginning it was just the 6 of us, and we accomplished great things. We got championships together, and I will forever be grateful to each and every one of y'all. To the whole team at Power 105.1, DJ ProStyle, DJ Self, DJ Clue, Angie Martinez, Honey German, DJ Sus1, DJ Will, DJ Ramo, DJ Nori, DJ Whatever, love. Let's keep making history. To our syndication company, Premier Radio Network's Jennifer Limegruber, Martin Malias, and Dwayne Crawford, thanks for your support as well. See, this is the part where I get in trouble because I start saluting my radio people, forget someone, and they will be like, why you didn't big me up in your book? Look, to all my radio folks across the country, I love y'all. Let's keep pushing the culture of radio forward. Please don't be mad I didn't salute you in my acknowledgments. Blame it on my mind, not my heart. Salutes to Devi Dev, K Fox, TT Torres, Letty Martinez, Carolina Bermudez, Cubby Bryant, Lulu and Lala, Erica America, Bobby Bones, Producer Eddie, Radio Amy, Elvis Duran, The Godfather, Greg T, Froggy, Scary, Bethany Watson, Danielle Monero, Garrett Vogel, Jim Kerr, Bob Bronson, Helen Little, Big Boy, Sway, DJ Head, DJ AO, DJ 33, DJ B-Lord, DJ Chuck T, DJ D-Nice, SC, Kendra G, Taylor Hayes, and Nessa. To Anita Scipio, a.k.a. Mama, love your energy. To Paul Anderson and Workhouse Media, thank you. To my Viacom family, Paul Ritchie, Candida Boyette Clemens, Chris McCarthy, Darren Byrne, Ryan Ling, Annie Gillies, Brian Saracusa, Jessica Zalkin, Lauren Zins, Tiffany Williams, Darah Cook, Rachel Edwards, Shelby Krasnoff. I don't know why MTV2 gave me a deal about 4 years ago, but thank you for seeing that in me when I didn't even see it in myself. Esther Park, Kathy Palmentary, Eli Lehrer, Catherine McAloon. What up, Kat? Essence Stewart, thank you all. To the Wardrobe Mafia, Taisha Ampadu, Alicia Keener, and Sather San. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I just realized I don't even know how to pronounce most of y'all names correctly. That's why I give all of y'all nicknames. To everyone I met on this TV grind and became great friends with, Pete Davidson, Deezus Samero, John Gabris, Jordan Carlos, Jesse May Peluso, Damian Lemon, Carly Aquilino, Melanie Iglesias, Lisa Ramos, April Rose, Nicole Baya, Aquafina, Chico Bean, Zuri Hall, Carlos Miller, Amanda Seals, Chip and CP, Doug Banker. I love you all, and each of you have inspired me in various ways. To Randy Hatchell, thank you for providing me with so much great reading material over the years and for introducing me to Dr. Natasha Sandy, the best dermatologist in the world. To Matthew Benjamin and the whole team at Touchstone and Simon & Schuster, thank you. This book is the first of many, and thank you for believing in my vision. To my attorney, Lone Dang, thank you. To Jan Miller and Nina Madania at Dupree Miller, thank you both very much. I knew from the first time we had lunch, Jan, that we would do great things. Even if we weren't doing business together, I would still be extremely happy calling you both friends. Chris Moreau, thank you for telling me the two things I need to be doing, a book and a podcast. Hey, Chris, you were right, and I'm glad to be getting money with you on both those things. To the Loudspeakers crew, Combat Jack, Matt Raz, Kid Fury, Crystal, and Taxstone, be safe, though. My Brilliant Idiots partners, Andrew Schultz and Greg Schultz, love y'all, and let's keep winning. To my people at Marvel Comics, Chris Robinson, Blake Garris, and Sanford Green. Sanford, thank you for the Black Privilege illustration for the book. I'm framing that. Jesus Christ, this acknowledgement thing is difficult because it's impossible to acknowledge everybody, man. I got a really big team who I confide in and plot and plan with every day. Folks like Van Lathan, Jasmine Jazzfly Waters, Alicia Renee, Dolly Bishop, my brother DJFrosty.com, Karen Civil, thank you. Ashley James, Poo Poo, what's happening? Kente Palmer, my blood brothers and sisters, Teresa, Ashley, BJ, and Julian, love you all. To all the websites, World Star Hip Hop, Bossip, TMZ, Elliot Wilson and B-Dot at Rap Radar, YBF, Nicole Bitchy, This Is 50, All Hip Hop, SOHH, Hip Hop DX, Hip Hop Wired, Double XL, The Source, Vibe, The Shade Room, Baller Alert, DJ Academics, and everyone I forgot to mention, thank you all. To my triple OGs, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, Brother Don Muhammad, and the whole Nation of Islam, Assalamu Alaikum, thank you. To my great friend, Marvette Brito, thank you for believing in me and encouraging me since day one, and thank you for introducing me to the beautiful island of Anguilla. To all my Anguilla folks, Shaquille Cardi, Hayden Hughes, Delicia, and everyone at Tasty's Restaurant, Gwen and everyone at Gwen's Reggae Grill, salute to you all. To all the McKelveys on the planet, let's build on our legacy. My dog Lil Duval, he swear he stay out of the way of these niggas better than me, but nah, bruh. Peace to Nori, N-O-R-E, and the Drink Champs podcast. And salute to my guy, T.K. Kirkland. And of course, to my manager and business partner, Karen Kenny, thank you. You have upgraded my life, and you are a gift from God. Let's take over the world. To my assistant, sister, adopted daughter, Paige O'Donnell, I love you, kid. I knew you were special when you interviewed me for your college radio station at Penn State. After you got that internship at Power 105.1, I tried to shake you numerous times, but you held on, and I love you for that. Thanks for riding with the old man. I got you for life. My brother from another mother and the craziest dude I know, Wax. Something is really wrong with you, and I wouldn't change you for the world. Well, a few things. But you are the pure definition of loyalty, and we are going to keep growing. Salute to Big Diz, 6'4", Hype Man Coop, SDM. Lose some weight with your fat ass. Beehive, Vegas Jones, Tata, Shaka, Hove, everybody at Roc Nation. Thank you all. Mike Kaiser, Kevin Lyles, Jay Grand, Joe Yai, salute. Thank you to Natina Namin, who tells me she hates me all the time, but it's really because she loves me. Salute to my guys Tyrese, Wale, Timbo the King, and Killer Mike. Salute to Lisa Kennedy Montgomery. Sorry, Kennedy, just felt like putting your whole government name out there. My partner Chris Etheridge, RIP to Jarrell Garnett. Salute to Miss Jimmy Sue, my cousin Dana McKelvey, Lala Anthony, Carrie Champion, Bakari Sellers, Angela Rye, Pastor Carl Lentz. Hey, Pastor Carl, thank you for the constant texts and reminders that God is real. My favorite corporate thug motivator, Gary Vaynerchuk. To Mike Love, George Cook, Rochdale Queen's Finest, the Evans family, Dr. Robert Evans and Robert Bless Evans, everybody in Kiffield, Highway 6 in Whitesville in Monk's Corner, South Carolina, peace to Berkeley High School, and my cousin Mal Lawyer. Look, these acknowledgments could go on forever and ever, but if I forgot to give you your due, just know it's almost midnight, and I have to be on the Breakfast Club at 6 a.m. If you know me, you know that gratitude is always my attitude, and I'm definitely grateful for everyone that I have met on my journey. Always remember what God has planned for you. Nobody can stop you but you. Thank you. See to God.
Black Privilege. Opportunity comes to those who create it. Was written and read by Charlemagne the God. It was recorded at iHeartRadio Studios in New York by Dwayne Crawford. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. The associate producer was Jennifer Lopes. Black Privilege, Opportunity Comes to Those Who Create It, was produced and directed by Paul Fowley. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Black Privilege, Opportunity Comes to Those Who Create It, is available in print from Touchstone.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.